or 100 or more. You make such programs as Pacifica Performance Showcase or Global Village, arts and culture, music programming, and current affairs programming possible. Please ensure that KPFK's February Fund Drive gets off to a good start by calling in with your gift now to 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. And thank you for your support.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. We cover news and public issues affecting areas students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. I'm fortunate to be the head of journalism and the student media advisor, so I get to advise folks like the two that will be on the show today. Our first guest today is Brian Antunes, a senior multimedia reporter at the University Times. He reported for Santa Monica College's Corsair newspaper before transferring to Cal State LA, and has more recently interned at The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome to the show, Brian. Tell us a little bit about why you took on this story, covering the fires.
Thank you for inviting me to be here. So I took on this story because I just felt like it was really important to really showcase how these fires have really affected working class people. In the beginning, I felt like there definitely was a ton of coverage regarding which celebrities have either lost their homes and have had to evacuate. And it's important, obviously, to talk about that, you know, because losing a home is extremely tragic, regardless of who it happens to. It's like, it's devastating, you know, because of how many memories are in that home. Generations of families could be in a home, but I felt like we definitely do needed to showcase more of how this is affecting the regular person. So how is this affecting students and faculty who are at Cal State LA, you know, so we can actually know and be aware that there are people in our communities who need help and still need help.
Absolutely. And thanks for that. I know you interviewed several students, including two who lost their homes or they lost their parents' homes in the fire. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What did they say happened to them?
Yeah. So I interviewed everyone that I spoke to. I spoke to through Zoom because everyone is at different parts in the country, actually. Because the first person that I talked to, Bobby Enos, they were driving from the East Coast heading back to LA, and they just, you know, took a quick stop and just opened Zoom up on their phone, you know, and then we chatted, you know, and then they told me their story. And Rio Goodman, there with family and friends, they were able to evacuate from their home, thankfully. And they're still here. They're still here in the city of Los Angeles. And so is Seamus Bozeman, thankfully. So I interviewed them. And what they told me was that Bobby, their apartment is fine, but, well, quote unquote, fine, but in the sense of like it didn't burn down, but they cannot occupy it because of the severe smoke and ash damage that it suffered. They had to stay with family and friends after this happened. So they took a road trip across the country to go stay with family. And with Rio Goodman, their apartment is also quote unquote fine in the sense that it didn't burn down, but it does have smoke and ash damage, so they can't occupy it right now. And with Rio Goodman, their parents' home, which is also Rio's childhood home, burned down. And we even included photos in the story that had members of the family. They went back to the ruins last week, just try to see if anything survived. And they said nothing survived, unfortunately. And then with Seamus Bozeman, they said that their house also burned down and they had to leave. And they're currently staying with family and friends as well. So all these people, like physically in terms of being alive, you know, like they're thankfully safe. But yeah, they've definitely all been ravaged and rocked by the tragedy of these fires.
Oh, wow. So as you're doing these interviews, what was a moment when you're talking to these students where what they're talking about really stood out to you or where you felt it deeply. And, you know, sometimes we talk to our sources and they tell us something that sticks with us. Was there any moment like that for you?
Yeah, the things that really stood out to me the most was that Rio Goodman and I believe Bobby Enos both told me that, I'll start with Bobby, that they can't occupy their apartment right now because of the smoke and ash damage, but their landlord is still charging them rent. And the same with Rio Goodman, but there's another added stipulation to that. With Rio Goodman, their apartment also can't be occupied, but their landlord is still charging them rent. With Rio Goodman's parents, their house burned down, and yet they still have to pay their mortgage. And that to me is just mind-blowing. Like, and I saw a couple reports about it, but I wasn't sure if it was true, you know? But to hear it told to me directly from a student that I'm interviewing for a story, there needs to be more protections for people.
Absolutely. I can't imagine it either. Thank God that they're safe. The people that you interviewed and their families are safe. But at the same time, it is pretty surprising or shocking even. They can't live in it, and yet they're still paying rent. In the other case you mentioned, there is no home, and yet the family still has to pay the mortgage. Is there anything that these students or people who are going through this can do in order to get help? I mean, I'm wondering, did you consider reaching out to the bank and the landlord just to find out, hey, what's going on here? Like, why are they still being charged?
I personally was not able to reach out to the landlords and to the banks, all of the agencies, as to why people are still having to pay rent and pay mortgage. But I know that there has been a lot of work being done by activists in order to really push these policies, I suppose, because I know that there's been a lot of city council meetings and protests on the street of people saying that there needs to be a rent freeze, there needs to be an eviction freeze, or like a mortgage freeze. And the fact that this work is being done by people really is heartwarming. Not only just the three students I interviewed, but, you know, the thousands of people who have lost all their homes and lost all of their livelihoods and everything. I'm sure that they're like too drained and too busy with trying to deal with the aftermath of, you know, having to file claims with insurance companies and having to stay with families, trying to figure out when they're going to get their next meal or when they're going to have to pay their rent for their apartment that they can't occupy. I'm sure that they're a bit way too drained to be able to participate in these actions that are being taken. So it's really, really great to see that people are really stepping up and doing this work for them.
Yeah, that's definitely been a silver lining in all of this, is just how much people are coming together and wanting to help and wanting to do something. And speaking of which, I know you didn't reach out to the bank or to the landlord, but did the students tell you anything about what they're doing or what their insurance companies, I think the one whose parents own their home, you know, how is the insurance company factoring in here? How are they helping? Are they getting help from FEMA, for instance? And what kind of other help are they getting from the community?
So where the students are now, they're all safe, thankfully. They've all been evacuated. They're all staying with friends and family. Like Bobby Enos, for example, they had to go across the country and stay with family and friends. And they're essentially going to be like couch surfing for the meantime, you know, and the same with Rio Goodman and Seamus Bozeman as well, that he's also staying with friends and family in the meantime. And I know that with dealing with insurance companies, that it's been a very, very hard process for them. Like, for example, like a really great way that Rio Goodman explained it to me was that they said that having to rebuild and having to recover definitely is like a second and third job, especially since they've never had to file claims or have had to deal with the politics of insurance companies, you know? So that to them is like a whole new experience for them. I can't imagine having to be in that situation where you're like, I lost everything and now I have to help my parents to deal with the insurance company.
You point to a really important issue, this idea that for decades, people have been paying their insurance premiums, never having to really file a claim, you know, maybe one in that whole time. And now a major disaster hits and they're faced with having to deal with their insurance companies. And there's a lot that they just don't know about filing claims, about the process. And that's another story that I think we as journalists need to stay on top of. I mean, I covered the Florida property insurance, and that was one big story, is how insurers, you know, some of them would strategize to deny claims because that's a big expense for them. And sometimes it was under the guise of, oh, well, it's a fraudulent claim. But there were examples and instances when you could literally see the damage and see that it wasn't related to just maintenance. It was definitely related to, for instance, a hurricane in Florida, right? And so I do worry that some of the insurance companies, you know, as their costs go up, they'll work to try to deny some of these claims, and that's going to put homeowners in a bind. I'm hoping that journalists like you and others at the University Times and Community News, with the LA Times and other outlets, are really going to stay on top of that part of the story too, is holding the insurers accountable. Anyway, so I guess at this point, I know that Cal State LA has some kind of a fund that it created to help students. What have you heard about what the university is doing to provide resources or services or programs that can help students, staff, and faculty who lost their homes?
So what Cal State LA is doing to support their students is that they started a recovery fund. When I interviewed Patrick Day, who's the VP of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management, as of that day, which was, I believe, January 23rd, he told me the fund had raised $32,000. He said that those funds are purely from on donations of the Cal State LA community. So whether it's students, faculty, and staff, you know, just helping each other out and wanting to help each other out. And I know they even sent out an email like to everyone talking about all the services that they still provide, which is like free Wi-Fi, and they reopened the food pantry. And they also told us that there's psychological services provided as well.
Thanks so much for your time and coverage, Brian. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you for having me on.
More information about Cal State LA's Recovery Fund grants and other emergency grants are available at calstatela.edu. Now, we're going to hear from another local reporter who's been covering the impact of the Eaton Fire on her beat, the city of La Cañada, Flint Ridge. Mia Alva is a Cal State LA grad and the University Times former editor-in-chief. She has been an Outlook newspaper's reporter for the past 2 years, mainly covering stories for La Cañada Outlook. Welcome back on the show, Mia. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Outlook newspapers these days?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I am the main reporter for the city of La Cañada, Flint Ridge, and I'm covering sort of all areas of the city, which includes city topics and city council meetings or school topics within the school district. But I also get to feature different residents and what they're doing to better the community. And then also sometimes I'll go to community events and see kind of what they're doing to support the community or just to raise funds for something.
So you've been really busy, like so many other local reporters, just covering the aftermath of the Eaton Fire and its impact on the city you cover, including some school district employees who lost their homes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, many of the employees and staff members lived in Altadena. It was over 20 of them that were impacted by this, either losing a home or have been displaced. So I kind of just went through the list, emailing a bunch of them, trying to see if they were willing to tell me their story, and it was very impactful.
Okay, and was there a moment in speaking with some of these fire victims that really struck you, that stayed with you?
Yeah. So I interviewed three of them, all teachers at La Cañada High School. And the one story that kind of impacted me was this science teacher who was telling me, you know, the timeline of everything that happened when the fire started, where they're at today with his family. And I think what struck me and kind of just made me tearful in the moment was that he was just so positive. And he was just so, like, he was thinking so positively during this and saying, you know, maybe this happened for a reason. I know there was a quote that he left on his board before the Eden fires. Destruction brings new beginnings, I believe it was. And I think that was really impactful because after he came back to campus and he found out that he lost his home, he saw that quote and it just really impacted him. And, you know, it helped him to keep going in this moment.
Wow. And you said that that quote was before the fire, right? So that's so prescient, almost like a foreshadowing. And so one thing I've been thinking about, Mia, is, you know, you're interviewing all these sources and they have their stories. But as I know, you also have your story, your own family story. I can't imagine how difficult it's been covering a story like this when you yourself and your family were so personally impacted by the fire. So I guess if you feel comfortable, can you please share with us how your own family was affected and how that may have affected your own work and coverage of this ongoing story?
Yeah, of course. So due to the Eaton Fire, my grandparents lost their home. They lived right across from Elliott, the school there, and they lived in that home for over 50 years. So it was very hard and really just unbelievable to understand at first, because my grandmother from my dad's side had also lived in Altadena and was displaced. So it was just a lot of unknown, you know, during all of it. And so thankfully her house survived, but my grandparents' home on my mom's side did not. So it's been really tough. I mean, like I said, it was shocking at first. I didn't believe it. And then I finally, like, you know, kind of realized it. I actually went to their house this past weekend. And that was really hard and just, you know, it sunk in. So with work, it was very hard as well, because at first I took a few days off just to process and, you know, kind of be there for my grandparents. But when coming back and interviewing, you know, these Altadena residents and these people who have lost everything, just like my grandparents, it was very hard, but also very inspiring. And I was just happy to do my part in my job and share their story. I mean, that's our job at the end of the day, is to spread awareness and to, you know, share stories of people who have lost everything. And in this instance, it's been hard, but I've been also motivating to see, you know, these people, these other people in the community of La Cunada step up and really help those in need, even if they weren't affected. One quote that stuck with me when interviewing people during this was, you know, everybody knows somebody who's been affected by the Eaton Fire, because that's the closest fire to them that happened. So that really stuck with me, and I can't stop my work and, you know, my motivation to spread the word, just because I've been impacted, because I know that everybody else has also been impacted.
You're right. We all seem to know somebody affected. And you're also right about the idea that, you know, if there's a drop of sunshine in all of this, it's really how the community has come out in droves to help, volunteer, donate supplies. I read your story about that too. Can you share a few highlights with our listeners?
Yeah. One of the things I was really surprised by and just amazed by when I started working with the Outlook is the students here. Obviously, they're part of the community, but the students here are really generous with their time. Even if they're so busy with school and other, you know, extracurriculars, they will leave everything aside to help. Early in my career here at the Outlook, I interviewed students who started nonprofit, you know, for a cause. And, you know, all of this was just like, wow, you're just a teenager, you know? So one of the recent stories I did was about this La Cunada High School club, this Filipino club at the high school, where, you know, this one student just saw what was happening with the Eaton Fire and dropped everything and wanted to get involved. You know, these kids just felt helpless. You know, they wanted to do something, and they were able to kind of band together over, you know, 200 students and just volunteer where it was needed. So that was great to see. They've done a lot of donation drives and food drives around Pasadena and Altadena.
Yeah, those kinds of stories have definitely helped through all of this, and just giving you a sense of hope, feeling hopeful for the future. So I guess to wrap it up, I mean, is there anything else that you want our listeners to know? What can they do if they want to help victims at this point?
I think what I've seen lately that has been very impactful is people looking within their own community and opening their homes to people who, you know, need a place to stay, or just reaching out to people that they know and asking if they need anything. You know, a lot of people have stopped donation centers because people just really need money, you know, to keep going in this process. So I think looking, I know there's a lot of different, you know, Google forms and things on social media where, you know, they have a list of Latino families who lost their homes or Black families who lost their homes in Altadena and Pasadena. So I think just digging deeper into your community and, you know, gathering people who have, you know, the same kind of motivation to do something like that is very impactful during this time.
Okay. And where can people go if they want to read your full coverage?
They can visit our website, OutlookValleySun.com.
Mia, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. It's always a pleasure chatting with you on the show and off the show.
Thanks for having me.
I also want to share my sincere thanks to you and your colleagues at La Cañada Outlook and at Outlook Newspapers for your essential local reporting and community coverage. Also, for our listeners, if you want to help Mia's family with our GoFundMe, you can find it by Googling the word GoFundMe and in quotes, write, support the Robles family after Eaton Fire. You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. After the break, we'll hear our student Haley Mosley's podcast about a topic close to her heart, mental health in the African American community, how it's viewed across generations, the stigmas that still linger, and more. Please stay with us.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Hi, it's Andrew Tonkovich, host of Bibliocracy Radio. My weekly books show moves to a new day and time on KPFK. Tune in for weekly books discussion and readings now on Thursdays at 2:30 following the excellent Los Angeles Review of Books LARB Radio Hour. Join me and writers of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, cultural criticism, and more at our new time, Thursdays, 2:30 on Bibliocracy.
We're back with the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown, an associate professor at Cal State LA. Mental health on college campuses is a growing concern, not just on ours. Social media, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, and other things have contributed to that. But not everyone seeks help. Haley Mosley wanted to tackle that issue in Professor Julian Reyes's podcasting class. Here's part one.
Hi, my name is Haley Mosley, and you're tuning into the Haley Fit Podcast. Today's episode is a very special and necessary one. We are discussing mental health and its importance within the African American community. And help me out, I have with me Dr. Carla Michelle, a life coach who helps high-performing individuals successfully find harmony in their lives and in business. So, welcome to the show, Dr. Carla.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. So let's just jump right into it. So I want to talk about age demographics of people who are seeking therapy. What are some of the most common age groups who do seek therapy today?
Well, I would say we're getting a lot of the younger generations because of all that's happening. You have in the school shootings, or we have a lot of the influence from social media, and it's become more accepted since COVID and how we saw with the pause of the world how much we had to deal with ourselves or how much we didn't know about ourselves, and seeking more self-awareness and dealing with stress. So we have the younger generation, but I would still say if you go millennial, if you go Gen, I don't know all the Gens. So Gen Z is the younger, right?
Yes.
We're seeing more of that. And still people are sitting on their own, you know, and wanting to do it their own way. But I think we see a much more younger crowd as well.
Yeah. How do you think we can get, I believe they're called baby boomers, the 40s, the 50s, yes, the 60s, on board for therapy?
You know, when you get to that age group, you probably think you know it all and you don't need to talk about things because you're learning to do it by yourself, right? You become this silo. How do we get them on board is, because I work with that age group as well, and it is, usually I have to sneak it in. Because if I'm working with you on your professional development, I believe you have to work on that whole person, so I can kind of push that in there when it comes to the personal development and really find the historical trauma. And I don't use that word, but it's a lot to do with that with them. and figuring out why they do the things that they do. So how do we get them in there? It's probably a little trick, you know, it's like, we're going to talk about something else or someone else's problem. We're going to talk about your child's problem, or we're going to talk what's going on at work, and then get in to see that let's talk about you.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost that
gotta sneak it in there. Outsmart them.
Yes.
So you said Gen Z and millennials are more accepting of therapy these days. What do you think about the pandemic affected us to seek therapy?
I think because we were really home. And before the pandemic, we had things to do, people to see, places to go. We had things to keep our mind off of depression, our frustrations, our hurt, our pain. Yeah. And then you're sitting and we're on lockdown. I mean, what are you going to do? You can watch television. But after a while, you don't have the things that take your mind off of you.
Yeah.
The parties, the, you know, hanging out.
Yeah.
It's just me. And suicide rates did go up during that time because there wasn't a lot of things to take our mind off of who we are and what's happening. Also, I found you had the high achievers in high school or college, and when they couldn't have that interaction in the classroom settings, or they couldn't get that, oh, you're doing a, well, you're doing a great job, look at this, look at that, and the other people could see that they're, you know, your other classmates. When you go home, no, there's no one there to compete against. It's just you. And then that's probably a lot of times people just only, that's where they find their value. Is you seeing how great I am? Because at home, maybe they don't have a parent telling them they're great, or maybe things are really rough at home, and they were able to find themselves. So I heard a few stories about kids, high schoolers in college, not having that validation anymore, and it really showing, like, you know, why am I here? Sadly.
Yeah. Do you think that therapy gives us a form of validation?
I think it should.
Okay.
I think it's,
yeah.
I think in some form, you don't want to go to therapy to be beat up. You're already coming in pretty bruised, right? I always say, if you could see us in a spirit, as a spirit person, you know, a lot of us are beat up, right? And bruised, and eye is black and arm maybe dangling, but you know, we're able to show up in a way and present in a way that looks like we're okay. So I would hope therapy is a place that we can feel validated and said, you know, say, great job, or I see you're changing, or I see the growth, right? That's what it's about.
I think about my own experiences in therapy, and it's funny because I'll say something and I'll have a vulnerable moment, and like, I'm expecting them to be like, well, you shouldn't have did it like that. And maybe because I've had some of that in my childhood or growing up, but it's always like, you're okay to feel that way. I was like, oh, I am okay to feel that way, you know?
What?
A lot of positive reinforcement. So I love therapy for those reasons.
It does give you that agency, because we do hear growing up, if it's not from your parents, it's from your teacher. You know, I'll never forget a teacher telling me I was taking Spanish and maybe I wasn't that good at it, right? I mean, gosh, come on now. It's like junior high. And she told me after class one day, I was going into high school, she goes, you know what, you need just to give this up. You're not good at it. So here's a teacher you think that's, I think she felt good about being honest. But I didn't let that stop me. Thank God that's a personality. I was going to say flaw, but I think it's definitely not a flaw. And I took it in high school, 4 years, went in AP Spanish, and aced it every year. So was it me or was it the teacher? And that's what we have to think about, even when it comes to therapy, when we hear what our parents have done. I'm a parent. We're not perfect. So is it the parent, or is it just who you're around? And sometimes that therapist gives you that, you know what, you're okay. You can do it, right? So
I love that. So how has the stigma around therapy changed across age demographics over the years?
Well, I'm going to have to still go back to the pandemic and what it did. I think it just made it more, and this, you know, things that are happening in the world with the, I hate to give air to it, but the shootings and the things that are happening, people, what else, where else can you go? You know, and not, you can go many, go somewhere else, but a lot of people are seeing the benefit. I mean, we have therapists at Kaiser still on strike because they're overworked, you know. So it's really picked up in the sense of the need and saying, and finding out, wait, therapy's not that bad. Like, I have like a, I have someone who, you know, wants to hear what I'm saying and doesn't put me down, or is helping me with steps, or helping me see that I made a good decision somewhere in here. And I think that is the most powerful thing, what we need. And so I think that's what's happened. People are seeing like, oh, wait, this is some good stuff here. Good stuff, you know, yeah. You got BetterHelp. Now you can go on an app. I mean, you can go on
and
YouTube. People who are not even licensed or even have the knowledge are given therapy. Yeah. So it's like everywhere.
Therapy's everywhere. I love that. All right. So I want to dive into maybe like the overall purpose of therapy.
Okay.
So how would you define the true purpose of therapy?
Well, you know, I could give you from my notes and look down and read that, but I'm going to go from what I feel.
Okay.
So, you know, therapy is a place like we talked about where you can find that fair ground, right? Lack of judgment, acceptance. Someone hopefully will tell you the truth. And I think that is what therapy is to empower and to enlighten. So you become more self-aware. You're understanding, well, am I this way? And they're like, well, you could be that way, but this is probably why you're that way. And so that awareness and openness to discovering more of who you are and then what you want to be in the sense of how you show up in this world. Mm-hmm. So therapy for me, and I do coaching as well, and that for me, it's just helping that person just see themselves in a new light and that they don't have to give up, that there's some resiliency there and there's a gift that they carry. Let's bring it out. I always believe you're necessary in this world. So let's to let people know who you are, you know, and let's believe in you so that you can make an impact or imprint the way that you see necessary. So I think it's an awakening in some form, you know?
Yeah. I love that. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about whether receiving life coaching or even therapy?
I think they see it like almost going to the doctor. You know, you're just going to get bad news.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're becoming more aware of that.
Yeah.
That it's not that. And then there's the thing that someone's just going to sit there and just let you talk and not have any conversation with, you know, like, oh, yes. And then an hour goes by and you go, okay, we'll see you next time. You know,
well, what did we really do? I just talked the whole time.
Yeah. And some people need some talk therapy, but there's also people who are looking for a direction that don't have an adult in the home or don't have a involved parent for whatever the reason. Mm-hmm. And you become somewhat of that person for them. And I think that's a misconception of that it's something that's going to put you down or something that's just going to go, oh yeah, you know, and just kind of listen and not give you any feedback. I will say this, therapy is what you make it. So if you're going to do therapy, go in with an intention.
Absolutely.
You also have to think about it's like dating. Find that therapist, that coach that works with you and works with your personality. Mm-hmm. It's nothing wrong with saying, I don't think we're a fit, right? Because sometimes culturally we cannot be a fit. Mm-hmm. There's that thing, I can have the same color as you and maybe get you a little better than someone who doesn't have the same color. Mm-hmm. And you can be picky like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing about therapy that people need to realize is that you have the power.
Yes.
It's not just you sitting in front of me and I'm just all up in it.
Yeah.
It's what do you want?
Yeah. So it's almost like you have to go into therapy with intention.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And if you don't have it, I'm sorry.
No, absolutely.
And if you don't have intention, I think the therapist, the coach should lead you to that. Like, you know, there's an intake form. And when they ask you, what do you need? What do you want? Why are you here? Tell, you know, I want clarity.
Yeah.
That's intentional. Yeah. But clarity in what? Clarity in understanding what my next steps are.
Yeah.
Because this is happening in my life. Yeah. That's enough intention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think sometimes, too, even for myself, when I first was going into therapy, it almost felt like, because other people around me were like, well, you should try therapy. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with me? Like, is something wrong with me?
Right.
Like, nothing's wrong with me. I don't need therapy, you know?
Right.
But in reality, it's like, therapy has helped me become a better me, you know? And that same thing about intention, like, I have questions sometimes before I go into therapy. Like, this is what I want to talk about today. This is what I need help with.
Good.
And so, because you can kind of get lost and the therapist is on the receiving end, right? But if you go in with intention, it's like, okay, I'm kind of navigating and guiding this session, essentially.
Right. Yeah. And it gives you that power. And a lot of times you don't, people who may go to therapy may feel like they're not empowered, but yes. That's the time you can, you know, either, because usually we work for somebody or we have a parent or someone we have to respond to or do for. Mm-hmm. Therapy is your thing. It's yeah. like, it's your world.
Yeah.
You own it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. It's very important to have that intention.
Therapy has almost become, because I'm a personal trainer, mm-hmm. and so oh. it's almost become not like a workout, but something else to do to feed myself. Does that make sense?
Oh,
like working out is me
sense.
Working on myself. Therapy is me working on myself.
Yes.
You know, like it's become one of those things like, okay, I get therapy today.
You know? I think they run neck and neck in the sense of what they can do for endorphins, you know,
yeah.
and to get you, especially when you're feeling lonely. I mean, I like working out. So, you know, I go there. It's great. It's great thing for therapy if you need it, but you still have things you just cannot get through that you need to check in with a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
But moving your body, getting that sunshine,
yeah.
taking care of your, like, not just self-care, but caring for yourself.
Yes.
It's totally different than just like I got a facial or, you
yeah.
know, it's like really taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
And therapy and working out is definitely like they date very well.
Yes. I say that massages and skincare, I say that's self-maintenance, like getting your hair done, getting your nails, self-maintenance. Therapy, working out, that's, I feel like that's self-care.
Right.
The inner work is, feels like self-care to
that's
me.
That's that inner work,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Because you can go get your hair done and still be sad.
You look good though.
And then you're like, don't make me cry. I just got my makeup done. Yeah. So it doesn't cover up much.
Yes. Awesome. So how can therapy help people who... This may be a little heavy, but who do not have a diagnosed mental illness or who do have one?
Yeah. Okay. How can it help it if they don't?
Yes.
Well, I think you don't have to wait until something is like, you know, depression is acute. You don't have to be diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think if it's just like something's off and I need to talk to somebody
mm-hmm.
and my friends don't get me or mm-hmm. my partner doesn't get me,
mm-hmm.
you know, let me go talk to somebody. It could just be that.
Yeah.
Because it is a time for you to unload what you need.
Yes.
And that someone who's not, like, we go back to not judging you,
yeah.
they're just open and hearing you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have been diagnosed, it's something to also help you work through the trauma that you've experienced
yeah.
that has maybe caused this diagnosis. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've been through historically, especially in the African American community, you know, with our men and women
yeah.
and in the brown black situations that happen in our cultures.
Yeah.
There is that part that we're just used to it sometimes. You know, you're just used to having stress or you're just used to having to be scared to walk the street.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just used to having issues financially.
Mm-hmm.
You're just kind of used to it. This
mm-hmm.
is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Though that's even just because you're used to it.
Doesn't mean it's normal or it's okay.
Doesn't mean that you have to just deal with it by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, because we can normalize hardships. And should we? Just
yeah.
because we can
mm-hmm.
and we're strong,
mm-hmm.
whatever we think we are. I think we play strong. We're not strong.
I'm actually very sensitive.
Right? Right. I mean, you know, I could come off a little strong, right? But I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, if it gets down to it, and I think that's what therapy lets you do to take off that mask
yeah.
and let you, like, just undress emotionally and
mm-hmm.
say, this is really how I feel when I have to work with couples or if I work with men and our young men, you know, how whatever age range
mm-hmm.
they come in. So like, yeah, and then I'd be, and then when they kind of get a little misty eyed, I won't say they cry,
yeah,
but when they get a little misty eyed and they're able to just kind of like let their guard down and they can just be authentically them.
Mm-hmm.
In those moments, you know, whether it's in their job, whether it's in a relationship, whether it's with their parent, wherever they are, whether it's their partner, and they can just be totally honest about their fears and their mishaps and their questions. Because I think we put a lot on men and expect them to know everything, do everything. Like, why, you know, especially if you're dating one, you're like, why don't you do this? And
mm-hmm.
you should be. And they're like, I don't know. They will never tell you they don't know.
Yeah.
Even when you hire them on a job, men don't. They will never, well, I shouldn't say never, but oftentimes they will not admit that they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They'll just figure it out.
Yeah.
So where do they get that moment where they could just kind of let themselves be like, I don't know what the heck I'm doing.
Yeah.
This
and
is
therapy
hard.
Is that moment for them.
That's that moment.
it's amazing. I was having a conversation with my mother, and she actually encouraged me to ask you about baby boomers.
Wanting to,
kind of being reluctant to therapy.
Yeah.
And she was telling me that my father mentioned to her that he wanted to, he was like, maybe I should do some therapy.
Yeah.
And she said that her first reaction was like, well, you can't talk to me.
No.
And she said sometimes that, you know, she feels like maybe women can deter men in relationships from receiving therapy because, you know, when you're, and they've been married for 20 plus years, you know, and so maybe they feel like they're one another's maybe soundboard in a lot of ways, right? But I think that to your point, you know, maybe a lot of African-American men don't have like that place to, like you said, emotionally undress.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can only do so much with your spouse, right? Because you still want to be that man, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and then tell the truth, ladies, if I don't know where you're sharing this. Like, do you really want your man crying all the time? Like, you'd be like,
stop crying.
Right? Like, I'm the one supposed to be crying, you know? Like, so really, do they even have a space? So, yeah.
It is.
We can try to be that everything, but. We judge.
Yeah.
We judge a little bit.
For sure.
You know?
You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown. We'll hear the second half of that conversation after the break. Stay with us.
This is Saul Williams, and I'm a proud supporter of KPFK because it supports our community.
With FEMA's recent announcement that the LA Fire Disaster Recovery Center at Pasadena City College permanently closed at 8 p.m. on Friday, January 31st, there are still two recovery centers that will remain open from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. in West LA at UCLA Research Park West, 10850 West Pico Boulevard, and at the Altadena Disaster Recovery Center, 540 West Woodbury Road in Altadena. At these centers, anyone who suffered damage to their home, lost personal property, or have emergency needs caused by the fires can get help applying for federal assistance, speak with representatives from state and federal agencies, and receive updates on their FEMA assistance application, or learn about the appeals process if their application was denied. You can also apply for FEMA assistance online at disasterassistance.gov through the FEMA mobile app or by calling 1-800-621-3362 with assistance available in multiple languages, including Spanish.
We are back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown. Next, we are continuing with the conversation Haley Mosley was having on mental health with Dr. Carla Michelle, a life coach, and they focus particularly on its impacts to the African-American community.
Okay, so let's move a little into therapy within the African-American community.
Okay.
Okay, so first question, how important do you believe mental health is for the African-American community?
I think it's very important.
Excuse me. And like, why is it essential?
Yeah, I think it's very important because of the historical trauma, because of what we've held generationally, what we see, especially when you have a lot of our men in prison and are just not in the home. And that is something that is just necessary to deal with and how to talk about it. And especially for our women who are just having to, well, I'll use that word, strong again, and to have to wear so many hats,
yeah.
You know, and to be that person to their children. That's why we need to really have those moments so that we can unearth the packed dirt that we just keep stumping on to get higher and stumping on just to survive and stumping on just to see the light of day, you know, and waking up and just trying to do it ourselves, you know. I think it's important because there's some hardships that we experience even being in the workplace.
Yes.
being Black as a man, being Black as a woman, yeah. and then promoting and things like that. That's important mm-hmm. to really see. We need to talk about those yeah. things because it's not always easy
yeah.
To deal with the stuff that. So I hope that we're in there.
Yeah.
I hope. I remember working with a young man. I did therapy and they were on the spectrum. And I was doing videos before video was in, before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so my face was up, but I couldn't see theirs. They didn't open their video yet. And I heard the little guy say, "Mom, she's Black like us."
Aww.
And I think that was the first time you ever saw a Black therapist,
yeah.
you know. And so that's even why, you know, we need more therapists who are of color
yeah.
because we're not seen either. And that's that we need that cultural awareness.
Yeah.
So you can say, I discipline my son
mm-hmm.
and I can hear how you discipline your child
because mm-hmm.
I know how I was raised,
mm-hmm.
right? So I get it
mm-hmm.
where some of the other cultures may be like,
yeah.
CPS, we have to call
yeah.
CPS. Cause
absolutely.
You, so,
yeah. So yeah. You think it's important like having someone you can relate to.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
That's why I say, you know, I believe now we're getting more choices. A lot of men, too, are showing
yeah.
up. A lot of Black men are showing up as therapists.
Yeah.
I think it's great. Hispanic men are showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Asian men are showing up.
Mm-hmm.
We need that. And when we're seeing that, you can relate.
Mm-hmm.
You put your guard down.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you get me without me saying. I don't have to say too much.
You get it.
You
yeah.
get it, right?
I don't have to say everything. I know you know, though.
Yeah, you know. You got to look that look. You know.
For
like,
sure.
You know can mean so many things.
Absolutely. I love that. So how has therapy been historically viewed within the African American community? I think you kind of touched on this a little
yeah,
bit.
But I will say a little bit more on
okay.
that because there was a time when, you know, we were used as guinea pigs in the medical field, right?
Yeah.
And I think that for our older generation will stop a lot of like seeking therapeutic help or even want to go to the doctor. So
mm-hmm.
they don't want somebody in their mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, per se.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still recovering from distrust
mm-hmm.
that you're not using this against me,
mm-hmm.
that this is something that's not gonna harm me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's still something in a lot of the older generation of why, yeah, we just deal with this ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have to remember the older generation and many of us were born in church, right? And so you have your faith.
Pray
about it. I got Jesus.
Yeah.
I don't need no therapy.
You need Jesus and therapy. You need Jesus and Ritalin.
Jesus ain't getting through.
Okay.
So you might need somebody face to face.
Yes.
You know.
Just to be a little transparent,
yeah.
I when I was a child, very hyperactive.
Yeah.
Wanted to talk to all my classmates. My mom took to the doctor and they assumed that I had ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they tried to put me on medicine. My mom wasn't really for it. Like, my mom was raised in the church, apostolic, Christian, wore skirts to school, couldn't get my ears pierced. Church on Sunday, church on Wednesday, church
okay.
on Saturday. You know, just very, very Christian by the Bible, right? As I've gotten older, especially this semester, it's my last semester in school. Thank you. I was in the classroom searching TikTok. Then I'm paying attention to the teacher. Now I need to go to the bathroom. I'm like, something's up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's too much activity here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to go back to the doctor to talk about ADHD, you know, and now I do take Strattera. It's a non-stimulant for ADHD. And in addition to going to church, in addition to praying, you know, and I think that, like you said, in the African American community, even though we have church, we still are human. You know, we still have to deal with the human side of ourselves. So.
Mm-hmm. That's very good that you went back and saw it for yourself. And I think, you know, there's what can we say against that someone's looking for that support and help because you feel it
yeah.
you know it's like I just need that support. If someone needs to be on some type of medication to help whatever you
yeah.
know to calm the nerves
yeah.
to help you think clearly
yeah.
to help your stress level
yeah.
then you know go I'm all for it
yeah.
because that is what you need
yes
right it's
yeah.
just nothing wrong I mean lay hands on me
yeah.
if that's
please,
gonna get
pray.
Rid of it I'm ready. You know, I'll take that too.
Yes.
But in the meantime, how mm-hmm. about we work together with, you know, some prayer and
yeah.
some prescriptions.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, like I said, I feel like my generation, we've accepted it a little bit more, but there's still
oh, yeah.
a lot of us who are like, I don't need that. That's
yeah.
for other people. That's for other cultures. No, it's for us.
Yeah.
You know?
And how do you know until you try it? Because you don't even know how you're going to feel. I've had many people like, man, okay, I knew something was up, you know, and then they get you know, something that helps them out, whatever it is, if it's ADHD or depression or, and they're like, wow, I felt like so much better. Mm. I feel so much more clearer. I'm sleeping better. So this, the life is better because of just, you know, trying something. You don't have to stay on it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Yeah. I remember going when I divorced and I needed a little something. I didn't know I needed something until I was at the doctor just for my regular checkup. Yeah. And I just cried. I couldn't stop crying. Yeah. She's like, so this is what I'm recommending. You want to try? I was like, oh no. You know, first I was like, no.
Yeah.
And then this is before I did all their, you know, schooling and training. And then when I did it, and it was like very small, like 5 milligrams. Mm-hmm. And so, and then I was like, oh, yeah.
This is better. We're getting work done.
There I am.
Yeah.
You know, because I still had to, going through the divorce, I had 4 kids, still had to work.
Yeah.
I was going to school full time, you know. So, yeah, I literally, Haley, I was watching TV and things went black and came back.
Mm.
That's how stressed I was. Mm-hmm. I was like, I didn't blink. Mm. It was just... That's how much stress I was under, not sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope this helps somebody and encourages somebody to seek help or, you know, to release the stigma around it.
Yes.
Yeah. What barriers prevent African Americans from accessing therapy?
Yeah. So that takes us back to that. I think it's a lot to the trust, spirituality, religion, what people think. What my mama think, you know, what my spouse or partner thinks.
Yeah.
I think it's just that judgment.
Yeah.
I think that makes you reluctant. And then, like I said, still the face, will someone get me, is the culture, you know, cultural connection that can hinder. And then cost. Sometimes if you don't have insurance covering it, you're out of pocket. And with that, you find someone on a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of companies or practices that work with sliding scale according to your income.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people who will do it, you know, free, you know, to help you if you're in that way. So it's, I would say whatever the hindrance is, just push past it and do what you need done so that you can feel better.
Yeah.
And it's not a quick fix. I have to say that. It is a commitment to work through something.
Yes. I think about when you say it is a commitment, it's not a quick fix. When I first went into therapy, even probably the first year, even two, I thought, like, why isn't it working?
Yeah.
Like, what am I not doing, you know? And I think once I started becoming intentional, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try therapy the right way this time. I'm going with questions. This is what I'm noticing about myself or in my life, whether it be dating, whatever it is, right? I think it takes knowing yourself, because if you don't know yourself, you can't help somebody else know you, you know? And I think that's what's really helped me. Like, I have to journal everything. And I'm like, okay, I'm seeing a pattern here. So let me talk about this with my therapist and see how I can give me tools to essentially handle that, right? And I think that's what therapy has really done for me. It's given me tools where I didn't have them before, you know? And it's been life-changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that, being intentional, but in knowing yourself. Because think about it. A lot of us, a high percentage, we don't know us. Like, who are you? who are you?
Yeah.
I remember someone asked me that, like, you know, in a relationship, like, what do you need? Mm. Right? And at that time, that was years ago, I'm like, oh, God, I don't know. I know what I don't like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sometimes it's the opposite of what you don't like.
Yeah.
But when someone says, like, what do you need?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know.
Mm.
And, you know, and those are the questions we're not raised around to ask. Mm-hmm. You know, you usually just do what I say.
Absolutely.
Now, why you don't think, just do what I say, you know, if you have that kind of parent in the house or school, you know, we're socialized to wake up, go to school, be in class, go on a break, go back to class, get a lunch, go to class, go home, do the thing, right?
Yeah.
And then we get a job, it's wake up,
sit
on a desk, go take a break, come back, go to lunch.
It's like school.
And so it's just the whole thing that we're socialized. So when do we get to really understand who we are?
Mm-hmm.
We're just sometimes this, I mean, I don't think we're all robots.
A little bit.
Feel a little robotic.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like, don't think, just do, just follow this pattern. And then I think that's why it's hard for people to be entrepreneurs and like
I was
own.
Just thinking that.
Yeah, because we're socialized to work.
Wow. I was just thinking that because I am an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you a lot of freedom. It gives you a lot of time to discover yourself. It gives you a lot of almost jurisdiction over your own life.
Right.
Like, whether right. opposed to working for somebody else or a company.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you want that money to come in, you're going to be very creative, too. So you're using a side of your brain, you're using the right brain
yes.
to be creative of, like, what can I do now
yeah.
to have this income? So, and so we're so limited just being under someone's umbrella of what, I mean, I think it's great if some people never want to work for themselves. I have no problem. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more life.
Yeah.
When you are able to use all of you.
Absolutely.
And knowing what you want and what you want to bring in the world.
I agree. Even to your point, when you said someone asked you, what do you need in a relationship? I think I just, probably this year, was able to answer that question. Like, this is how I need to be loved for this to work.
Mm-hmm.
This
right?
is, and I think I.
How powerful, right?
That's very like, much so.
And you were like, if you can't, then we're going to have a problem.
No, actually.
Right?
Yeah, actually.
You, just, you can't see her face, but it was like very serious. Like, actually, yes.
And that's helped me tremendously. It's like, oh, I know what I need now. Because
yes.
there was a point I didn't know. And I'm like, oh.
You know, Haley, sometimes we know what we want from a job more than we want from love.
Yeah.
You know, because we'll interview. Oh, I like this job. It has this, mm-hmm. this. But we fall in love. We're like, ah, just in love. Why? I just am.
It's like. It's in the clouds.
It feels just like butterflies.
Yeah.
You know, what happens when the butterflies are gone, you know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love
knowing
that.
Knowing ourselves.
Yeah.
I think it's just the most powerful thing we could ever do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I want to touch on normalizing therapy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So my first question says, what are the most effective ways to normalize therapy in this society?
You know, I like to normalize it in the sense, if you're going to do therapy or thinking about it, is think of it as a conversation. Like right now, we can say like we're in therapy, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a back and forth. Well, some people may not talk. It depends on the therapist's style. But it should be a communication. And, you know, you were saying, you know yourself and all that. I think it comes with time. Because as you said, you didn't know yourself. You mm-hmm. journaled. You did things to help you understand who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we normalize it is it's like a conversation. And if you're one that's not much of a talker,
mm-hmm.
then find something that works for your personality type.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably are a talker, just no one ever listened.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just time to, you're going to be heard and you're going to have a lot to say.
Yeah.
So you can normalize it that way, knowing that it takes time.
Yeah.
It's a process.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen in one session or
yeah.
five sessions.
Yeah.
People think, you know, can I just have a couple? Like, yeah, but we're not going to get to the root of anything.
Yeah.
So just know it takes time and it is the best thing you could probably do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's other things, but
mm-hmm.
this is one of the many best things you could do for your life
mm-hmm.
to help you find you.
Yeah. What would you say the timeline is if someone were to ask, you know, say someone's coming brand new
mm-hmm.
to you, like what's the time frame for them to, I guess, get the care, get down to the root
mm-hmm.
cause of whatever the trauma or the issue or...
Well, if it's like a something that's happening very present, like say a breakup
mm-hmm.
or you lost a life, you know, someone has passed away or there's trauma in the family that you're ready to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some things if it's just a situation
mm-hmm.
and you just need an answer and some direction that, you know, you can do that maybe 90 days. And I hate to put times out there because people are like, I only need 90 days.
The therapist said 90 days.
Yeah. And, but that's like a jump start.
Okay.
Okay. So that's a jump start
okay.
into continuing because that can just kind of dig around and find some things that help you go, oh, like
yeah.
those aha moments.
Absolutely.
But if you really want to see change that last,
mm-hmm.
oh, I have clients that have been with me
years.
But I think that is if you're hesitant, if you know deep down you want it, and you need it, please do it.
Yeah.
Please do it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show provides news about issues affecting the undercovered areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. That's all we have for now. Our executive producers and hosts for this episode are Professors Julie Patel-Liss and April Brown. The UT Community News Editors this semester are Alia Zavaleta, Andre Rueda, and Christian Rios. University Times reporter Brian Antunes and former UT Editor-in-Chief Mia Alva, who is now an Outlook News reporter, contributed to this episode. The music in Haley Mosley's Haley Fit podcast is from Envato. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks to our Cal State LA faculty and staff, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Joanne Lightford-Powell, Chanel Curry, Nithin Patel, Andrew Campa, Julian Reyes, Jade McKeever, Joseph Gallegos, Eliel Beltran, Jeff Fust, and Jesus Cruz. I'm April Brown. For all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for listening.
The first time I heard KPFK, it was in the wee hours, maybe 2 a.m., Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was like, what is this? What is this? What kind of radio is this? You know? I mean, it just blew my mind. And I got hooked right away.
KPFK.
Support for KPFK comes from the Hammer Museum at UCLA, presenting Alice Coltrane, Monument Eternal. The community comes together on opening night, Saturday, February 8th, to celebrate this exhibition with late-night gallery hours, open admission, and music featuring a special DJ set by Flying Lotus.